Everyone, it is my honor to have Claire Harrop, PhD, on the phone today to talk about sex differences in children and toddlers. This was actually a topic that some people requested off of a Facebook chat we were having. Claire got her PhD from the University of Manchester in the UK. She went on to do a postdoctoral fellowship with Connie Cassery at UCLA. And is now working at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She works very tirelessly and writes grants persistently and doggedly to ensure that boys and girls with autism are being studied in the right way. So the focus of today's podcast is really going to be, how are we studying boys and girls with autism? How are we finding out if there are any differences and when? I want to thank Dr. Harrop for being on the podcast this week. Start out with a question that you can answer however you want. You have been studying boys and girls with autism in a variety of settings for a number of years, looking at when they emerge and how they emerge. Can you talk about how you've been approaching this?
Yeah, so my work has utilized a range of methods to understand females and how and when they differ from males. Typically, I focused on younger children, so children under the age of 6, which we typically think of as early childhood. But we've recently extended this age range to include 6 to 10-year-olds. Our methods have included parent-child interactions, looking at play behaviors, toy choice, and repetitive behaviors. And we really focused on parent-child interactions as much of my early PhD work and my work at UCLA focused on these interactions due to their prominence within the early intervention models that I trained within. We've also used traditional researcher-administered methods such as the early social communication scales, which often serve as a baseline measure within intervention and as a measure of change over time. More recently, as part of my postdoc at UNC, we've been using eye tracking to look at social and non-social attention and how this may differ between girls and boys. So I've been collaborating with Noah Sasson at UT Dallas and some researchers up at CHOP to extend some validated eye tracking paradigms to a large sample of elementary school-aged females, but also develop paradigms that consider gender more carefully, building on emerging research that suggests differential social motivation and interests in females.
What's your perspective on whether or not there are different signs and symptoms of autism in girls and boys, or whether the tools that have been developed to look at signs and symptoms in autism are not sensitive enough in girls than they are in boys?
This is obviously quite a big debate right now, and there's been a handful of really good reviews that have dug into this. I think a circular issue and a tough issue that we have in our research at UNC and research in general is that we include females who already have a diagnosis. These are girls that have made their way to the clinic and have got a diagnosis. I think a key next step is for us to understand whether these behaviors and differences extend to what we might think of as subclinical populations, so unaffected female siblings, or what we might term sub-threshold females, those that don't quite meet criteria for ASD, building on the influential Dewinsky 2012 paper. And this is obviously a really hard group to get hold of. But we certainly are seeing across a number of different methodologies that females seem to present slightly differently, and their trajectories seem to change a little bit over time. During my postdoc at UCLA, we found differential associations between core behaviors, so social communication and repetitive behaviors, and development, both measured through cognitive development and with age as well. And these sex-specific trajectories have also recently been supported by Will Mandy and colleagues in the UK using a large birth cohort examining autistic traits over development. I think overall, the profile that we see for girls might not traditionally fit with what we see as autism that has been developed through years of research and clinical practice with majority male samples. So we all have to think a little bit differently when a girl presents themselves in the clinic.
Can you give an example from your own research that does suggest or does show that girls present a little bit differently than boys?
Girls seem to be a bit more socially motivated, or at least express their motivation in different ways. We found that girls play slightly differently with slightly different toys. We found that on the PAC study, the girls that were in the study played in the same way as boys, but they played with different toys. And this has been supported by a range of methods now using parent report and self-report. We also know that girls seem to show fewer and or different repetitive behaviors. And this seems to be particularly apparent as children get older. But we also know as females get older, particularly in adolescence, these protective factors seem to slip and they seem to be more vulnerable for comorbid conditions such as anxiety and depression. This may also reflect changes in social expectations and the changing role of female friendships that leaves females a bit more vulnerable. So I think studying females across their lifespan and looking at trajectories is really important.
You kind of just answered this question, but I'm really fascinated by it. So I want to kind of flesh it out a little bit more. In your most recent studies, you looked at different motivators for boys and girls and how they influence social attention. So how did you do that and what did you find?
So we had two studies that have recently been published. Our first study that was published in Autism Research extended No Assassins paired preference paradigm. This is a really simple eye tracking paradigm where a face is presented on a screen next to an object. And the object is either classed as low autism interest objects. So examples include trees, furniture, flowers, or what we think of as high autism interest objects. So trains, clocks, and computers. And it's important to remember that these interests have been classified over years of research with majority male samples. In the 2014 study, they found that social attention was reduced when paired with high autism interest objects, but the study only included one female. So our recent study had over 20 females and we applied the same protocol in the same paradigm. While we replicated the broad findings of the original studies in ASD males, the presence of competing images, whether they were high or low autism interest, did not increase the time females took to orient to the face or their overall attention. They attended more to social images and their attention was more comparable to females without autism. So it could be that they are more socially motivated or the competing images were simply not interesting to them. And our second study that was recently published in the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, we adapted another of NOAA's eye tracking paradigms. We presented our children with a series of visual search arrays. And this is when a number of images are presented on the screen at the same time. And the goal is to examine the distribution of attention across image types. Typically, these include social and non-social images or high or low autism interest images. But in our study, we used images of toys and interests typically classed as male, female, or neutral, as we were interested in whether gender played a role in the distribution of attention, building on this converging evidence of more gender normative interests in females. Again, we did not replicate previous diagnostic effects using our modified design. Both males and females, TD and ASD, attended to images that corresponded with interests and toys that typically aligned with their gender. That is, females attended to female images, males to males. Interestingly, our males in both groups were more detail-orientated, attending to male and neutral images multiple times. And this extends previous findings, but not to females. So this repeated attention seemed to be a male phenomenon that supports components of the extreme male brain theory, but does not extend this to females. So overall, the two studies seem to suggest that interest and social and non-social attention in female may align more closely with what we see in TD females than what we typically have reported in ASD males.
So just so people are clear, what are some examples of some, you know, some images that were of high interest or would be considered of high interest to boys versus girls?
For boys, it was things like Lego, Star Wars. We had some sports things in there. For the females, we had things like Furbies, Shopkins, My Little Pony. And prior to launching the study, we did a small online survey with parents just to make sure our classifications were right, that what we were classing as gendered they were as well. A lot of the things that we included were trends at the time. So there's things that now might not be as relevant. And that is one of the issues with using a paradigm like this. We have to update it a little bit based on current interests. We really didn't see that much attention to the neutral images as much, which was interesting. These were things like an easel, a paddling pool, a Nintendo Wii, things that we thought were a bit more neutral and less gendered.
In the ADOS, right? So if you're doing a diagnostic assessment of a child, part of it is a clinician kind of observation, different situations. And different toys, and there's a standard kit, different toys are kind of brought out, and the child's attention to different toys versus the examiner following, you know, different kind of attention stimuli is given. Does this suggest that perhaps there might need to be some tweaking of this for boys versus girls? Like, should there be a female-specific kit to maybe detect if there are potential differences to kind of better detect what they're paying attention to?
We discussed this in the paper, and as you say, the tasks and objects we use may not be as sensitive. Now, the ADOS is so well validated, but if I think about some of my own ADOS administrations, so an ADOS birthday party might look very differently across an ASD male or a female who's really interested in dolls. So females may be able to use their interests, for example, in dolls, and their play may be scripted, but in a brief assessment, it might not stand out as much. I remember doing an ADOS, and it was a module three, so with a verbal child, and we were playing together during the make-believe play. And when I came out of the assessment, the mum said, "Oh, that's totally scripted off YouTube." But because it involved using characters and it was a little bit more female than we might see, I didn't pick it up, and I have quite a lot of experience working with. So I do think it takes quite a skilled clinician to figure out some of those things, particularly if girls are able to use camouflaging in a way to mitigate some of these difficulties.
That's interesting what you say about YouTube, because I know a lot of girls with autism spend a lot of time watching YouTube. And you know, this is kind of an open-ended question, but do you think we're going to see different ways for girls with autism to camouflage? Is this possibly a bad thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I will say on the current study that I work on, I have never watched such a variety of YouTube videos. I think one of the goals that we're really interested in our work, and I am really interested in interest-based learning and not making people reduce their interest and trying to use them in a functional way. With our work, we're really interested in if females do have this protective effect and to really understand whether it is an actual protective effect or whether it is a learned behavior. So parents would say things to us like, "She's looking at you, but she's looking through you," or "She's looking at faces because that's what she's been taught to do." And I really like the quote from Kevin Pelfrey describing camouflage as, "It's exhausting because it's like you're doing maths all day." So I think our results, and in general, we don't know whether this is a true advantage and whether it translates to a real advantage in behavior or whether it could actually be a negative impact. So this is just exhausting for girls that they're practicing and they're camouflaging. That's something that we are really interested in.
So, because you trained partially with Connie Cassery, I have to ask this question. Do your findings potentially impact newer interventions specifically for females?
I do think we're not quite there yet to directly extend to interventions, but we've certainly thought about it. So I think our field as a whole, and this is a big NIH push at the moment, we really need to evaluate or reevaluate sex as a biological variable and also gender to consider how our previous research may have been driven by disproportionately male samples. And our findings add to this growing evidence base that the ASD phenotype may differ for females. And most interventions have been developed based on the well-validated and understood male phenotype. So you could argue that females may respond differently to peer-based interventions, particularly if they are interest-driven, if they are more socially motivated and their interests mesh more with what we see on the playground during recess. or they might progress differently in play-based interventions due to their toy interest. We just don't have the sample sizes right now to do that, but I think it's a really interesting point.
People who are listening to the podcast probably want an immediate answer, right? Like, okay, well, how is this particular study going to change the care for my daughter? But I also think it's fair to say there's just still not enough girls participating in research to make the jump to say, all right, well, now we're going to change the standard of care for girls versus boys, or what we're doing for girls versus boys. We know still very little about girls. Would you like to comment about that?
We're lucky to be really well resourced at UNC, and it took a long time and a lot of effort to recruit just, I think we had 28 girls overall. And there's obviously some big nationwide efforts. My next grant, I'm working with Kevin Palfrey, who obviously has his big network study. And there are some people out there doing great work. Renee Jameson at University of Kansas is doing some female work called Girls Night Out, which I think is really interesting. There's people certainly looking at this, but it is definitely hard to get the sample sizes.
Well, thank you, Claire. This is definitely a topic, as I mentioned, that people want to hear about. It seems like we get a ton of questions about sex differences in autism and sex differences in autism across the lifespan, because as you mentioned, sometimes the differences are very subtle early on, but as individuals go through different changes in social structure, puberty, or stresses in schools, then certain features may come out differently. So I think it's really important to study across the lifespan, and that includes young kids. So I think people forget that we don't want to completely ignore young kids. We want to include adults, but not exclude anybody. So was there anything else you wanted to add or anything that I missed?
No, I don't think so. I was going to talk a bit about what we're doing next. So we really want to understand how deep this protective effect goes. So whether it is surface level attention or whether it translates to a real advantage. And we presented some emerging data at INSAR this year using more ecologically valid eye-tracking paradigms of social scenes. And our next goal is to understand whether the protective effects that we've observed extend to differential processing of social and non-social attention at a neural level using electrophysiology combined with simultaneous eye-tracking as well. To really understand if they connect, whether what we're seeing at the attention level goes to the neural level, which would suggest that this is a protective effect. We are, so my grant is using 2 to 8 year olds, and it's combining with some of Kevin Palfrey's data, which is 6 to 14. So we're doing it across an age range.
And then do you think, because you are looking electrophysiologically, I know that that this is still early work, I know that it's still very too early to say, but could this potentially lead to a new way to diagnose girls if they have a different neural synchrony with what they see versus how their brains respond?
I think that's a million-dollar question, if we could really figure out when girls come in at 2. I think there's just differences on multiple levels. We're seeing it based on observation. We're seeing it on parent report, clinician report. We're seeing on eye track. We really want to extend our eye tracking down to younger kids as well to understand whether this is a learned behavior or whether it is something we see in 2-year-old girls. So I think it's going to take a multifaceted approach to really understand how and when girls differ.
Are the differences in social motivation, and I think maybe girls with autism might be able to particularly answer this, is that something that's learned? Or is that something that's inherent?
I think the infant sibling studies are a good way to look at some of this, to look at female protective effects within a sibling population, because that can give you an idea of genetic input and a little bit about biological variants, but also nurture. I'm very interested in parents' views on how parents perceive gender within the context of neurodevelopmental disorders and development. And I think infancy studies are a really interesting way to do that.
Thank you again. Thank you very much, Dr. Harrop. This was a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening this week. I hope you felt it was as fascinating of a topic as I do.